Felina Jean, and this is Black Broads Abroad. I'm an international woman of leisure who said peace out to the United States in 2011, and I have not looked back except at this ass, honey. Since then, I've lived on 4 continents but traveled to over 40 countries. Along my journey, I've come to know some very compelling Black women from all over the world who also said fuck you to their comfort zones. I created this podcast to inspire Black women in the diaspora to take risks and live their very best lives. Roseanne Achmed is an ambassador, advocate, activist, champion of the arts, a cultural practitioner, and preservationist. Born in West London to Sudanese parents, her formative years were abruptly disrupted when, while living in Kuwait, she suddenly became a refugee and her father and uncle were taken hostage when the Gulf War broke out. As the youngest appointed editor in British publishing, Roseanne joined RWD magazine and took lead in discovering, cultivating, and pioneering the UK's biggest urban music and lifestyle publication. Throughout Sudan, South Sudan, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and more, Roseanne developed a series of monumental campaigns surrounding arts and peace and has been recognized by the United Nations, the government of Sudan, and the government of Southern Sudan for orchestrating the country's first celebratory concert, highlighting the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. Throughout her continued support and cultivation of African culture, music, and fashion, Roseanne launched Africanism, a platform to redefine the continent's artistic authority at home and abroad. Continuing with fashion and merging her humanitarian efforts, Roseanne's most recent endeavor, The Magic Drive, focuses on sustainable luxury and tourism and expansion education to ignite the creative potential of orphans and other children in crisis in Kenya and beyond. Welcome, Roseanne.
Thank you so much. Wow, what an intro. Beautiful summary.
My goodness. Like, just a little bit of backstory. So I mentioned offline, you've been on my hit list for a minute. You know, I don't know you formally, and you never know, like, when you reach out to people, how minimal they'll be. But I'll say, like, I literally hit you up yesterday and you were like, okay, let's do it tomorrow. And, you know, people with far less, you know, accomplishments sometimes will stun on me. And so,
wow.
I appreciate that. You came out the door real quick.
Yeah, I know. You're most welcome. I just feel like, you know, if it sounds right, do it immediately, you know? So I'm happy to be a part of this and thank you for including me.
Thank you. Give thanks. So, okay, you're currently in Kenya. Do you currently reside there, or are you working? And how have you been doing just amidst this pandemic, professionally, personally, otherwise?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question. Well, Kenya is very much a second home to me. And I definitely have dreams to reside here eventually. But I don't know if I can permanently call it home as yet. I'm a bit of a global nomad for a very long time. And going on to the COVID element of the question, I think what Corona's really done for me is shown me the power of stillness. And being in one place so I can activate amidst calmer circumstances, which has actually been really beautiful. And I'm actually now considering choosing a permanent physical home. Although in my mind I have plenty of homes. I'm a big believer in Pan-Africanism, so a lot of African countries are my home. Sudan is my original home, where I'm from, but I'm also born and raised in the UK, and I have very close ties to Arabia, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, so Mm-hmm. Yeah, mentally I'm all over the place, but yeah, I think it's time now to put some roots, physical roots down.
Yeah, I'm feeling the same way. I mean, I kind of have, but I don't know. It's just, if you understand, just that nomadic lifestyle, it's very difficult to be like, okay, this is where I'm going to be and this is where I will remain. So have you been impacted by the pandemic at all professionally?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. A lot of my work focuses on people, connection, strategic convention, dialogue. I'm a big believer in conversation being the spearhead to development. So a lot of my work centers around human connection. And obviously, COVID has taken that away from us. So yes, I have been impacted, but I'm doing the best I can to be positive and to find ways to continue that necessary dialogue and cultural intertwine build, etc., through other means. But I'll be honest, I don't appreciate technology very much. So I don't even know. I think we just have a really weird relationship. Me and tech have a weird relationship. It's like toxic. We need each other, but we hate each other. So
I feel you.
Yeah, so I'm doing the best I can to readjust, and actually the reason I'm in Kenya is I really want to use this time to focus on retreat and program building for the Magic Drive. So that's why I'm here.
Okay, and I have some questions later on in the interview about Magic Drive, because you're doing some awesome things with children in crises. So we'll get into that. So, okay, I mentioned your bio. You're really such a compelling woman, and you've had a gamut of experiences that I kind of touched on. You've contended with that people would very well fold from and break from, but here you are. Viscerally tuned in, pharaonic natured, Muslim born, British bred, Arabic speaking, immitigable, globalized Nubian. As your IG bio would state, like you get the prize. You get the prize for the best and most specific IG bio. But
I try and make complicated things a little beautiful now and again.
That's one of the reasons I reached out. I was like, yeah, I gotta interview her. So, but taking it back just to your early years, you were born in London to Sudanese parents. What was your upbringing like early on?
It was complicated again. So I was born in London, but we actually spent some of my formative years in Kuwait. Back and forth, we were between Kuwait, London, and then we settled in Kuwait, and then obviously the Gulf War happened, which you touched on. But it was really, it was an interesting time for me growing up, and a bit of a crisis by way of identity, because in the UK, as much as I was English outside of my house, inside my house, you know, my parents made absolutely certain that I grew up as a Sudanese young girl. So, you know, too English to be Sudanese, too Sudanese to be English, too Arab, because obviously I'm from Northern Sudan, and Northern Sudan was impacted by Arabization and whatnot over many years of invasion and colonialism and whatnot. So too Arab sometimes to be African, too African to be Arab. So it was just a really strange dynamic for me. I never really knew where I fully fit in, where I was never 100% comfortable. And it wasn't until later, I guess in my early 20s, when I realized actually how opportune this was, how I was able to kind of mix and understand and relate to so many different identities and cultures. And I decided to take advantage of that and realize that, you know, this third culture phenomenon that existed within me was actually a superpower as opposed to a crisis. So like I try and do with most things in my life, I try to turn crisis into opportunity or crisis into something beautiful. Or, you know, understanding layers and the complexity of the human being is something that I've grown to really love as opposed to be, you know, intimidated by. So, yeah, it was complicated, but I made it work.
Yeah, it actually does seem to be a reoccurring theme in your life, you know, turning crisis situations into beautiful situations. They just turn into the catalyst for something much greater. So you did mention that you did live in Kuwait. At what age did you move to Kuwait, and how was your life suddenly uprooted as a result of the Gulf War?
So I was born in London, in West London, which I still consider home in every way, particularly when it comes to my friends and those I grew up with. Born in West London. And then when I was, I think, two or three years old, we moved to Kuwait. And I was there until the age of 9. Around 9, 10. And we had gone on holiday, my mother and my siblings, to Egypt. So we were in Egypt waiting for my father to arrive. And the day my father was supposed to fly out to meet us in Egypt, he was trapped because a war kicked off in Kuwait.
Wow.
The day my dad was due to fly out, like on his way to the airport, he heard news that the airport had shut down and there was a war. So, and I'll never forget the sight I saw when I woke up that morning. I walked out into the living room. We were staying in my granduncle's apartment. And I remember so vividly seeing my mom sitting on the couch, and my mom at the time was 7 months pregnant. And I remember seeing her like kind of like flinchingly holding on to the remote control. The remote control was kind of like falling off her hand because I think she was either in shock or she'd like gone weak, but she could barely hold the remote. And she was just staring at the TV screen and crying, just tears falling down her face. But she was so still. And I was like, Mama, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I looked at the TV screen and I remember seeing like tanks and the newscaster saying something was happening in Kuwait, but I didn't fully understand. I was only 10 or 9 or something. And then my mom kind of looked at me with tears in her eyes and she said, Kuwait's been invaded. Our home's been invaded. So yeah, it was shocking, but because I was so young, again, I didn't fully grasp the seriousness of what was happening. And then we couldn't go home. My dad was stuck, eventually taken hostage with my uncle. Our house was used as some kind of army base. I think geographically it was ideally located for them or something. Yeah, so soldiers took over the home. Funnily enough, my dad and my uncle said that they treated them fairly well. Like they didn't go through any kind of torturous experience, but they were held captive.
Wow.
Thank God. Yeah, thankfully. But they were held captive in the house. We basically had to leave Egypt and go on to Sudan because my mom had to figure out what to do with us. We couldn't go back to school. She couldn't go back home.
Wow.
It was. And again, I didn't realize the seriousness of it, not only because I was so young, but also because the grace in which my mother dealt with everything. At 7 months, she was 7 months, no, 6 months pregnant. I'm sorry, she was 6 months pregnant. The way she handled everything. She kept us calm. She kept us collected. She put us in schools. And it wasn't until my father managed to escape Kuwait and get to the UK, back to the UK, is when we joined him in the UK. And then, you know, I resettled back into West London. But
wow.
Yeah, it was definitely like, again, not until I was older did I realize what my parents had gone through. They literally lost everything. And we started from scratch.
Wow, what an incredible story. So how long did the displacement of the family last? And then how did that early experience inform the Magic Drive, which is a project you're working on that supports children in crises on the continent?
I think my whole life experience has been one where I have felt, sometimes I would feel a sense of loss because there was always this, I think the PTSD that came from that moment or that period in my life was this kind of like ingrained belief that nothing really lasts, you know, and that I could lose everything at any point. So and again, it wasn't until much later that I realized that this was a psychological issue, like a real issue of trauma within me. And I suppose it shaped a lot of my career decisions in the sense that I would always lean towards projects that I knew I could control, that I could start and finish under my control. Do you see?
I see. Yeah. Okay.
It informed me in ways I never knew. And I really had to sit back and check myself and reflect and understand, you know, the relationships between my experiences and my decisions. So I suppose the role it played in establishing the Magic Drive, because as much as it is an amalgamation of my passions within the creative and cultural industry, it's also an amalgamation of my personal experiences, and that is meeting with children and wanting to see them thrive and understand the potential of their immediate vicinity. You don't have to leave. You don't have to jump. You don't have to go from place to, you don't have to do that. You can really thrive and build and understand the power, not only within yourself, but when I speak of self, I don't just mean your physical body. I mean your immediate vicinity and the possibilities that surround you immediately. I guess it's really about, and also just finding beauty in the most unexpected places, because I was forced to do that growing up. Mm. You know, I was forced into scenarios like that. I ended up in a random school in Sudan, and then I was in a random school in Wembley in West London, you know, and I had to deal with the dynamics of also being Black in the UK. I didn't even understand what being Black was. I didn't know that. I was a Sudanese
right
guy, you know,
right?
So I didn't even understand what that meant. Like, people would call me Black this, Black that, and I'm like, what are you saying? You know, like, what? I'm not even Black, I'm brown, actually, you know, like, it's just, I didn't even understand that terminology, like how the Black label associates with people of African descent. So it was really, I was thrown into adjusting and thrown into finding beauty in the most obscure, unknown places. And now I like to encourage that because I think it's a beautiful skill.
So what are you teaching these children, like, a skill set? A fair portion of them are orphans. What exactly do you do to support support children in crises?
So my background also falls into fashion in a big way. And the reason why it does is because I'm um, you know, in my swirls and explorations and discoveries around identity and how identity impacts not just self but commercial opportunity and whatnot, I've realized that expression through clothing is something that really tells me a lot. There's beautiful stories around clothes, and I think the most, you know, the most inspirational people in my life are fashion designers like Coco Chanel and a lot of fashion designers that I've actually mentored over the years. They inspire me because they're able to tell stories of identity, stories and, you know, of people and society through clothing. And there is also an immediate transformational power in clothing, in fashion, that I wanted to tap into in a more impactful way, socially impactful way. And by that I mean, so if you, let's say you bought a nice dress, right? And you're on your way to a gala, you put the dress on, you do your hair, you do your makeup, and all of a sudden it gives you this new, like, finesse, you know? It gives you this new, yeah, this new confidence. You sit up better, you speak better almost. Like, that power is so immediate in terms of transformation. So I realized, you know, how can I use clothes and use this immediate impact to build confidence and to build it quickly? So that's essentially what the drive does. We use clothes. I basically, you know, want to address sustainability as well within fashion, and rather than these brands throwing their clothes away or burning them, which is what a lot of them do and affecting our environment. It's horrific. It's horrific.
So problematic.
It's so problematic. Fast fashion is the number two polluter on the planet after oil and gas.
What?
Yes, it's the number two global polluter. And a lot of people don't know this.
My goodness. I'm floored right now. Are you serious?
Yeah. Yes.
Burning shit, burning clothes that could be like donated. You're fucking kidding me right now.
I swear to you.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I believe
it. Burning the clothes, dumping the clothes, and obviously affecting economies by doing that. Africa tends to be a dumping ground for the choice. Yeah, like the dumping ground for clothes, for plastic, for so on and so forth. So I thought, you know what, let me tackle that disgusting, you know, polluting system and encourage brands to rather than do that, give it to us. Let your clothes, your creations enter into a system of education, empowerment, confidence, and rebuild, re-enjoyment, you know? So that's essentially what we do. We get the clothes, and we, after a series of intense exchange, we style, photograph, and organize a fashion show, a beautiful fashion show.
And intense the power exchange.
Intense exchange, yeah.
I know you are not a game in a negotiation. I can already see.
Definitely not. and I say intense exchange because it's transformative. It really is. Mm. And I think you know, and I had doubts too. You know, I thought to myself, you know, can fashion really, really do this? Like, can fashion really make a difference in these young people's lives? And, you know, we're five or six programs in now, and it really, really has transformed these young people. It really, self-appreciation is powerful.
It really is. How you feel about yourself is the foundation for everything.
Period. That's it. So I'm really happy with how we're moving along, and I can't wait to, you know, to see the program blossom and grow into 2021 and beyond. And we're not next week, in about 10 days time, we're organizing our first socially distanced fashion show.
That should be dope.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm really excited for it. And so we've had like initial meetings already, and everyone is. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Wow. Oh, that, yeah, that's mm-hmm. It's an interesting pivot we're all having to make right now. Fast forward just a little bit. I mean, you're still a relatively young woman. You've had your hands in music and politics and art and mm-hmm. publishing and fashion. Was it your intention, or, I mean, did you set out to converge all of your talents into this formidable calling, if you will, that spans across the globe? And I ask this question because, you know, so many of us as women are told to focus our attention on one conventional career path, or motherhood, or being somebody's wife, you know?
Yes.
But you've proven that women can walk and chew gum at the same time, like we always do, but you're at the forefront of doing like the antithesis of what we're taught to do. So, I mean, was that intentional? Was that intentional? Was your career path intentional in that way?
It certainly wasn't intentional at all. I don't think many of us make a choice to be, to be confused in their potential. 'Cause, for a long time, I was confused because I also followed that thread or that understanding of one label, one course, one path. But again, purpose is intersectional. I think it has to be. I think that if you have a vision, you have to be intersectional and you have to be multidisciplined, because if you really want impact, you have to kind of be everything in a way. And I thought about it for a long time in a very practical way, because a lot of people, how people, when they meet you, they say, what do you do for a living? What do you do for a living? And I always found it so difficult to answer that question. Always. And even in interviews, when I started receiving media attention for my efforts or for a particular project or for my advocacy or my opinion, a lot of journalists would be like, well, how do we label you? What do we call you? And I'm just, it really started to aggravate me as to how I should label myself. I thought of people like Kanye West and Michael Jackson and Pharrell Williams and presidents. I thought of presidents. And I just thought to myself, well, why can't I be the president of my own world? Why can't I be a president?
Right.
Yeah, because presidents have their fingers on everything. They have to run a country. So they have to consider culture. They have to consider youth, music, what impacts society. They have to consider all of these things. And then they have to consider commercial objectives within that impact, and then they have to look at political implications and ramifications, and they have to look at means of foreign diplomacy and how other people perceive their nation, So then this goes into PR, and this goes into image and brand. So these are all things that I consider on a daily basis, not just within what I've created, but within the societies that I believe in and love. So I have a presidential view on not only my career, but on life.
What is your birthday?
I'm a president.
What is your birthday, girl? You have massive big dick energy. What is your birthday?
I don't know if that's a good thing.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. That is wonderful.
No, that intimidates men. That's the one area where I struggle. I'm still very single.
Well, they like compliant bitches and shit, the ones that can mold and shit, confident women, shit, got it hard out. See, that's why That's why folks is switching over to the stands, girl, but that's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other conversation, because that honestly, like, people love to well, I don't know if they love it, but like, I am constantly assumed as this, like, you know, this bad bitch, this boss, this, you know, and as I'm a traditionalist too. You know what I mean? I'm old school as well. I'm domesticated as well. I like to cook.
Right.
You know,
that part.
And I love to serve men, by the way. I love it. I love serving men, and I love men serving me in their way, you know, in the only way they can. And I just feel that, you know, I'm not a hyper feminist, despite popular belief. I'm really not. Like, I'm not.
Right.
I'm a womanist. I'm out here being the best woman I can be, you know? Mm-hmm. And I hope that I can find one day, or he finds me, the best man he can be. And I really believe in that, you know? I don't know why a woman, a powerful woman, a confident woman, needs to be feared. I don't know why. I don't understand.
They scared
that.
As hell, especially a black one, honey. Everybody's scared of us. You know.
Yeah, it's such a shame. It's such a shame.
It is. It's exhausting.
It is. It's exhausting.
As fuck.
And let's be real, it's also a little lonely. It can be.
Well,
For me, it can be, because I do feel misunderstood quite often, and I just don't know why. As much as I am an intersectionalist at work, I'm an intersectionalist in life. You know, I can't wait for the day that I establish my domestic empire. I can't wait for that, when I'm raising my kids and we create our coat of arms as a family. And you know, and I'm there being, watching my king do his thing and thrive, and, you know, me being his the stroke to his painting, the key primary stroke to his painting. You know, I look forward to that. I think it's a beautiful
thing. Are men intimidated by you? Like, how does the opposite sex approach you? How do they even approach you?
I generally am never approached.
Really?
Yeah.
Me too. Yeah. I mean, well, the ones who approach me, you know, white men and lesbians have all the confidence. They don't have no problems.
Well,
approach it.
Well, I don't have white men or lesbians coming near me.
I don't know why. I'm like a white man and like a lesbian magnet for some reason.
Well, I mean, at least something's happening, right?
Well, I mean,
at least you're getting some attention from somewhere. I mean, at least attention is coming your way somehow, some way. Whereas with me, I honestly don't know. You know, I find it unfortunate. I do, because if anything. You know, one would see a woman that's committed to her purpose and committed to her.
Right.
To her journey. Someone so committed, it should show that this is a disciplined human that understands commitment and understands understands the hard work required to build. So therefore, you know, if I was a guy, I'd be running after
women.
You would
want
you,
right?
I'd be running after women like us. Yeah.
It's weird, girl. It's weird.
It's very weird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. we could go off on a whole tangent about that. But speaking of women, because you've embarked upon this another project, because obviously you've proven that you're a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And you serendipitously met Prince of Saudi Arabia, Fahad Al Saud, and partnered with a company. Is it called Naam? How do you put it?
Naam, yes.
Naam, okay.
Yes.
Naam,
which means
okay.
Yes in Arabic.
Right. And the project, you guys launched a series called Saudi Girls Revolution, a series of interconnected video games and comic books. So this is a twofold question. One, okay, dispel any myths around gender equality and women's respectability politics in the Middle East. And why was this project so important for a male, for, you know, the prince, as a man to embark upon this project?
So Fahd is one of my dearest friends, as well as a fantastic colleague that I've worked with on a number of projects. But he grew up with women, and he'll tell you himself that he values women more than men on this earth. He respects every single female force, that he calls them a force in his life. His mother, his sisters, his aunties, myself, people, women that continue to touch his life. And as a young Saudi man, he wanted, who's also intersectional in his POV, and in his practice, he wanted to create something that spoke to both his love of comics and his love of technology and his love of women. So he created, and he's got this such a vivid, incredible imagination. So he created Saudi Girls Revolution without any political intentions, by the way. But as Western media love to do, somehow they associated a comic, a children's comic, with, you know, they politicized it in many ways, and I found that tragic, because I've never seen a Disney movie being politicized, you know. I've never,
right
yeah, like when I never saw you do anything with Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin, like, or any kind of Disney making movie has never been positioned or questioned with political direction. So we actually had to deal with a lot of retaliation because of that. But the intentions around creating this beautiful comic series was purely just that, a personal appreciation, respect, and love for the women in his life. And he wanted to propel that as well. He understood and knows and lives the fact that Saudi women are, not all, of course, I'm generalizing right now, but there are many Saudi women that are powerful, that work hard, that are in great positions, that actually love being at home also, love being wives, love being mothers, you know, and he wanted to celebrate that layered superpower that exists within the women of his nation, and women in general. And he asked me to come on board as editor, because I am Arabic speaking. I'm therefore an Arab, I suppose, but I'm also an African woman, and I'm also a British woman. So he appreciated the nuances that exist within my life experience, and he wanted that incorporated into the story.
Wow, it's such an awesome project. You know, I lived in the Middle East for 4 years. I lived in Qatar. And, you know, there's so many things that I actually miss about gender segregation. So many.
Wow.
So
yeah.
Many.
Yeah, me too. I love it. I honestly love it. So
I do too. I mean, people look at it as like oppressive. No, it's like, it's so nice just to be in women-only spaces. And
Yes. And also, you know, I actually posted about this. It's funny you highlighted this, because I posted about it just yesterday that... And I made a comparison, and the only reason I made a comparison with the United States is because, you know, there's a Western, there's a Western hyper feminist voice or voices that generally love to condemn or, you know, scream about the oppression of women in other parts of the world, when actually in the United States, there are more women imprisoned in the United States in jail than anywhere else on the planet.
Hello.
Yes. So I found it to be an interesting comparison. You know, you have more women in prison than anywhere else in the world, and yet here you are trying to tell me that I'm not free because I'm in Saudi Arabia or I'm in Bahrain or I'm in the Middle East. And actually, I feel more liberated, more safe.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, more safe and more free in this part of the world than I ever have. In
anywhere else.
Anywhere in the West. Yeah, anywhere Western.
Anywhere. Yeah, that's a fact. That's a fact. It's interesting. I had another guest who works in Saudi. She's from like the Washington, D.C. area. But she made such a good point because like there was like all this headline news about Saudi women just being able to drive. Qatar women drove. Oh, yeah, they was whipping they Rolls Royces like nothing. Like, yeah.
Casually.
casually. Just a Tuesday afternoon. how Saudi that women just got the rights, secure rights to get driver's licenses. And she made such an excellent point that people might not think about, like, women don't drive there because, you know, they're viewed as too precious to undergo such a, you know, such a menial task. Like,
it's true. It's true.
She's right.
It's also because I don't know if you've been to Saudi Arabia, but I mean, Saudi men aren't they're a little crazy with their driving. so there's a safety factor too. You know, it's the preciousness, it's the safety. It's like, you know, these men are, it's a little wild. The streets are a little wild. So it's not just because it's some kind of a pressing thing. She has a point. It's a lot to do with the woman being driven. Or, you know, the preciousness of the woman. That is a true aspect as well. And actually, now that women drive, when I went to Saudi recently, I still saw the streets primarily occupied by men. So sometimes it's a choice too. Sometimes women are just like, I don't want to be driving in these streets.
I prefer being driven.
And there's Uber now. And
yeah.
I prefer being driven too. So, and there, you know, there's Uber now, and you know, the women that are willing to drive are driving. And you know, and the Thrive was in place well before that came into play anyway. Driving wasn't the primary concern as well. There were other factors that the women in Saudi were arguing for and advocating for. So, yeah.
And you mentioned in your bio, you consider yourself a globalized Nubian, and I very much consider myself a global African citizen. So as such, okay, having lived in how many countries and continents have you lived on at this point?
A
lot.
four or five continents now. Yeah, four or five. And multiple countries as well. But I'm firmly rooted in being Sudanese, in being a Nubian. And I think that once you have that solidity, once you have that firm understanding of who you are, it's possible to walk within any space and feel comfortable.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
That was,
yes.
Yeah, that was my kind of approach eventually. You know, I think before working out, you know, where to be or where you should be, it's important to work out who you are, first of all. And once you've done
that's a word.
That's a word. Yeah. Yes. And once you've done that, it's pretty smooth. But listen, it's not like, it doesn't just, this approach or this idea doesn't just come about. It requires a lot of self-work. And I did a lot of work before I reach this point of comfortability in myself. And there's still work, you know, there's still more work to do. I think it's a constant process of learning and unlearning. So yeah, it continues.
Yeah, it's a continuous process, so never ending. What's the biggest lesson that you've learned about stepping outside of your comfort zone?
The biggest lesson I've learned is understanding the similarities in difference. So let's say I step out of a personal comfort zone, I try my best to find what is similar in this new zone, you know, the similarities in our difference. You know, if it's a brand new project, for example, I always like to give solid examples because I really don't believe in speaking hypothetically. I always like to give tangible physical examples. So the crux of my work, you can say, is focused on communication. That's really what it is. It's communicating, storytelling, strategically, you know, building key conversations, projects, ideas that that is firmly rooted in the art of conversation. Even artistic exchange leads to talking. So if I am to enter any space, I believe, you know, in order to tackle and get comfortable within an uncomfortable zone is to talk. Yeah. And exchange and understand and empathize and then build accordingly. So talking, that's been my biggest understanding of getting comfortable.
That's, yeah, having uncomfortable conversations even. Yeah.
So, but then that leads to comfort. It leads to comfort. It really depends on who you talk to. I was having a great conversation the other day with a young activist here in Kenya, and you know, what I loved was that she was confident in herself and she was able to stand by her opinion, and I was able to stand by mine with due respect for one another. You know, and no extremes. Like, one of the most difficult moments I think we're going through right now is the lack of understanding and just kind of extreme, like, you know, the presidential election right now happening in America. You know, like things like that.
Girl,
you know, it's horrible. So I'll just, you know, I'll say one thing and then immediately I'm put into this extreme left or extreme right kind of box. And I just, that's what continues the discomfort. A discomfort is to just go to an extreme, to not listen. So I really believe that talking is key. And this is why I have been able to cultivate and build new culture and have others see the beauty. It's through that power of exchange.
Wow. Speaking of, the birds sound so beautiful in Kenya, by the way. It's been like an ambient undertone throughout the entire interview.
That's great. Yeah, no, it is. It's beautiful here. It's really beautiful here. Really peaceful.
I need to have one of those talks. I have he's like my little brother. He's like my Morehouse little brother. And oh my goodness, he's a Trump supporter. And I'm like, there's all of these things. You went to an HBCU, you're gay, you're black, and you're a vociferous Trump supporter. Like, we just can't discuss politics. He gives me heart palpitations.
but it's good to understand his perspective. You know, if I was to meet him, I would want to know why he's a Trump supporter and listen to his argument.
There's nothing wrong with that. Fox News regurgitated nonsense.
That's a shame.
I mean, You know, yeah, if it was a well-crafted argument with reason, the only reason you should be voting for Trump is if you, I mean, you can't have no nigga pennies. You can't qualify for no stimulus check and a vote for Trump. I mean, I could understand voting for him as a bipartisan businessman, right, which is immoral in and of itself, in my opinion. But, I mean, yeah, you qualify for a stimulus check. Right. Come on. You should be socialist all the way. Anyway, what is next for Rohan, and where can people keep up with your journey on social media?
What is next? I am very excited to finally find the time to write my book. So that's in the works at the moment.
Yeah, please do an Audible. I'll
work on that. Yeah. I'm still fine tuning like means of presentation and also how to even like divide the book. I'm thinking at the moment of a series of short stories based on life experience. So there's that. The Magic Drive is in kind of full drive right now. I'm in Kenya and I'm really looking forward to expanding. And also I've been at the moment looking at locations for a curated retreat that I'm putting together, targeting specifically creative executives. And I can't wait to get that going. And I also am really, really happy and looking forward to really just spending time with myself. That's what I've been doing for the past 2 to 3 months now, just really just spending time with me and working on myself and my body. And I'm like, I'm tapping back into Dr. Sebi, who was like a second father to me.
I interviewed him when I was like 22 years old. He's an incredible man.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to just, because it requires a lot of, you need to be on your own and like, you know, I've been having like bathing myself in sea moss and like, you know, things like that. So I'm really tapping back into just, you know, being with me and I'm loving every minute. So, socials, I am Rosanne, everything, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and RosanneAhmed.com for, the future. There's lots to come. I'm excited about utilizing technology now to increase conversation. I'm trying to like, you know, build a better relationship with tech. She's so weird and rude and toxic to me, but right. I'm making it work. And yeah, I'm excited for Africa. I'm really, really pleased with developments in terms of Renaissance and artistic expression, movements in fashion. So keeping a close eye on that and making sure our creative and cultural industries speak to the power that they are.
Well, thank you for allowing God to use you as a vessel. Yep, I appreciate your work.
Thank you. And I thank God too, but he makes it a little bit difficult sometimes. a little bit overwhelming at times, but I'm grateful and I thank him too. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you so much for your time.
Shout out to our Patreon members for your support. If you too are interested in joining the Black Broads Abroad movement, you can follow us on social media, and that's BLACKBROADS. That's on Instagram and Facebook. And if you'd like to become a supporter on Patreon, you can do so on patreon.com/blackbroadsabroad. This episode of Black Broads Abroad is brought to you by Amaka, a new digital platform that spotlights incredible stories about women from Africa and the diaspora. Amaka was born out of the necessity to diversify our media landscape, and they'll be doing exactly that as part of their virtual summit happening next month called Our World Festival, which is a 3-day interactive virtual conference celebrating Pan-African womanhood running from May 2nd to the 4th. The free conference will feature 9 different events and over 20 speakers with immersive sessions exploring economic empowerment, wellness, cooking, travel, mental and sexual health, and much, much more. Get your tickets now at amaka.studio/experiential. That's AMAKA.studio/experiential.